Hello and welcome to The Tips, a brand new weekly podcast from the DP World Tour. We're only a few weeks old, but we've already got a special episode because it's Major Week, golf fans. This week, we are going to be looking at the PGA Championship from Oak Hill Country Club in New York. With the help of some expert guests, we will be diving into the facts and figures to provide some insight into where the value may lie. Before we start, it is important to note that this podcast is aimed at listeners aged 18 and over. All odds were accurate at the time of recording, and the betting information is aimed at a UK audience only. Please remember to gamble responsibly, and for more information, visit begambleaware.org. Joining us again this week, we have DP World Tour commentator Kit Alexander, as well as freelance golf journalist Matt Cooper, who featured on episode one. And making his debut, his first appearance on The Tips, we have Tom Jacobs, who works for Odds Checker. So first up, let's get into last week's results. Starting with you, Tom, how did you get on both sides of the Atlantic?
Yeah, so it was actually probably not the best week for me to start, actually. It was a tough week over in Sedan in Belgium. I basically put a lot of my hopes into Santiago Bentario, who ultimately didn't quite have it over the weekend. And then in the Byron Nelson, I was going with the veteran with Matt Kuchar, and I was hoping there was going to be a bit of a renaissance. And it was actually from Jason Day instead, which was lovely to see. I was really, really pleased for him. I wish he'd done it a week later because I bet him 100-1 to win this tournament back in January. So maybe if you can go back to back, that'd be great. But certainly not 100-1 anymore.
Yeah, those odds have well and truly gone after his his win, sadly. And we'll speak to Kit about Jason Day shortly because he's already joining the mystic ways of the podcast. But Matt, you had a bit of interest and knowledge on Simon Forsstrom, who went on to win the Sudal. You have some sort of theory, as always you do.
Yeah. I can't claim to have been backing him. I had all my hopes on Ewan Ferguson last week, and it was a classic week of two steps forward, one step back for him. But Simon Forsstrom, I am absolutely convinced he is David Guildford reborn in a Swedish guise. It's just extraordinary. It's the steady swing. It's the diffident nature that he walks around the golf course. It's even the fact that he peers after his ball with a slight sort of quiet resilience. It's just uncanny. I'm just hoping that he gets to the Ryder Cup and he's paired with a superstar of the European game who's slightly confused about what this man is doing next to him.
I don't think anyone will argue with you because no one knows if it's right or wrong, but we absolutely love it. And he really led the Scandinavian theme there. He obviously won. Dantorp was second, Ollison third, Bjork fourth, which was, I don't know, that's probably ever happened. We can get Kit to find that out. And also, Kit, talking about that, the AT&T Byron Nelson, Austin Eckroat got a big shout out as well in one of the episodes, and Jason Day went on to win. How much did you enjoy that tournament?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. We always kind of know that's going to be a bit of a birdie fest. They made a bit of a half-hearted effort to toughen it up in some way. I think, do you know what? Sometimes having a birdie fest is fine. Not every golf course needs to be like the one we're going to talk about this week, which is absolutely brutal. The best players in the world, if you get 150-odd of them on a golf course, a fair few of them will figure it out, whatever the golf course is. So just accept it's going to be easy. And it made it entertaining viewing. You know, we had, what, six guys tied for the lead or something heading into the back nine, a host more within one or two could have won it. It was an entertaining watch. In the end, though, as you alluded to, I'm delighted Jason Day got over the line, because in the very first edition of this podcast, I predicted that Jason Day would win and get into the winner's circle again this year. And I'm very grateful that he hasn't made me wait too long to deliver on that promise just a couple of weeks later and back in the world's top 20. I think I said at the time he was playing the kind of golf that actually got him to world number one and made him a US PGA champion a few years ago. And I know that, you know, Tom, having put him up at 100-1, doesn't necessarily like that he's won the week before, but it's that strange sort of paradox, isn't it, where you hate it when a player wins the week before you fancy him, but if he'd have finished second, third or fourth, you'd be like, oh, he's trending nicely, this is brilliant. But no better trend than winning the week before. And I know there's everything else that goes with it, but ultimately it's the same mentally as if you were in contention but don't get over the line. So I can only see that as a good thing for Jason Day coming in here. So delighted to see him back in a winner's circle. I think he's a great addition to the elite of the game when he's playing his best.
Yeah, well said. And it was great to see Jason Day win and hold off Scottie Scheffler, who was obviously joint leading. A lot of people thought he'd run away with it on the back nine, but couldn't quite get it done after a very impressive opening round. But Kit, you did just do a paradox, which we only leave to Matt Cooper. Sorry, no more of those things. So
you put the word in my head, I couldn't resist it. Such a good word.
But as you say, it won't be a birdie fest this week. So I think it's time to get into the action this week of the PGA Championship from Oak Hill Country Club. Yeah, the field this week is as strong as ever, with the top players all heading out to New York for the second major of the season. Justin Thomas comes to Oak Hill looking to defend his title that he won with a playoff victory coming from behind against Will Zalatoris at Southern Hills 12 months ago. The tournament's returning to Oak Hill for the first time in 10 years. We saw Jason Duffner win here in 2013, his maiden major victory with a two-stroke win over Jim Furyk at the time. Now, the course, a lot has been said about it, a lot of videos on social media. It's almost 7,400 yards, the East Course, we'll be playing to host this championship. And if you are a 14 handicapper at home, with a slope of 151, you'll be given 26 shots around this place. So don't expect anything incredibly easy. And that's probably a bit more relatable. But we've heard about a lot of changes, Tom Jacobs. Can you tell us what the key ones are? And with the extra length being added, are we looking for just distance, or is it fairways with the incredible rough we're seeing on social media? What type of play is this course suiting?
So I think the thing with the rough is that we always see a rough video before a major championship. And I'm never quite sure, you know, whether it's that difficult or not. We find out, and then we thought that, and then Bryson DeChambeau plays out the rough and things like that, winged foot. But for this course at Oak Hill, you know, as you said, par 7 is nearly 7,400 yards, will differ over the week. But I think it is majority distance, but we see all the time in these US Opens, US PGAs, that you rule out half the field because they don't hit it far enough, and then they litter the kind of top 20 and top 10. So if Zach Johnson can win at St Andrews and Augusta, then I think anyone can kind of win any tournament any given week. So I always hold that firm. But yes, I think it will be distance. I think mainly it's the fact that you focus on these par fives that stretch over 600 yards. It's a time where you can't dominate and you can't relax on any point on this golf course, I don't think. I know the kind of back nine may potentially open up some scoring opportunities, but to me, like, when you look at Andrew Green, he's potentially going to be the new open doctor, as they like to call it. So we'll see what he does with this renovation and go from there. He's also on the task with Eastlake as well, I believe. So original Donald Ross course, that may play into some people's minds with Eastlake and places like that. Runnymede is one I certainly looked at. And then it's a case of just trying to compare it and find the best links, which maybe we'll do as we go on.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much for that. And as you said, the changes are everywhere. And we love social media. Someone drops a ball on a tough green and it slides off. And we know all about that. And they are running quick, we have seen. So Matt, looking back, the innings we could really find was 2013. The Duff Man got it done then. What have you watched from that or learned from that that you are taking and bringing to your tips and previews this week?
Well, I think I'm probably on trend with Tom in saying that it's easy to look at 2003 and 2013 when it's hosted previously in this century. And you look there and Sean McKeel, one of the great old-fashioned PGA Championship journeyman winners, he and Duffner, and also the guys that finished second behind them, they hit a lot of greens in regulation. Now, that just, it kind of feels like the old-fashioned way that a PGA Championship was played. And to what extent that's going to be the case this week, who knows. But against that, they could be hitting lots of greens in regulation, whoever wins this week, but they're going to be doing it in a different manner to the way that it was done in the past. I have come up with a sly angle this week that part of me isn't convinced about it because of the distinct nature of this redesign, which is quite big. But I'm calling this the Colonial Legacy. And it is the fact that people who've done well in major championships at Oak Hill have got a very good record at Colonial. Carrie Middlecoff, Lee Trevino, Jack Nicklaus have won. The people who finished second there have done very well. Curtis Strange was a four-time top five finisher at Colonial. And then Duffner, Furyk, Tim Clark, Chad Campbell, who finished second behind Sean McKeel, they've all finished second at Colonial. Now, in one sense, that doesn't make any sense. Colonial is an old-fashioned golf course with dog legs. This course is mostly straight holes. But I think what it probably does do is it's about people who are getting it in the fairway, getting it under the greens. Now, the big point that's going to be different is Colonial is not a long golf course. This one is. So I'm I've got that in the back of my mind, but probably it's a bit like the Donald Ross one. This is going to be a bit like a Donald Ross golf course, but a little bit different. But there might be an element of the way that Wentworth got redesigned about this. You go to like the 17th hole at Wentworth, for example, and you kind of like think, I know where I am, but it doesn't quite look the same. It's a little bit like when you've seen somebody who's had like bad plastic surgery. You know the echo of who that person is, but you're sort of a bit confused that it's not. What would happen if you met an aging Hollywood superstar kind of thing?
Okay, that is very helpful insight. And the players, so maybe it'll be help people who haven't actually been there already, so they don't have these memories false information, essentially.
I think that's actually a very good point. And I think it's probably had a bit of an impact occasionally at these places where there are big changes. Think back to how when the Masters was played in November and it was very damp, the players who had all the course experience were dropping the balls with their approaches in old spots, and they weren't getting the same response. Now, I don't think that's the same here because we don't have many players who've got experience of Oak Hill. I think Dustin Johnson and Adam Scott might be the two nearest the top of the market. But it can often be the case with redesigns that actually sometimes it's better to have no past experience of what you're looking at.
Yeah, I did look into that and I saw Day and Scott both came eighth here, and they both had very good weeks at Akron and Firestone a couple of weeks before. Was a bit of a trend people were looking at back in the day there. I mean, it is looking tough. I saw Matt Fitzpatrick put a picture, a 232-yard par 3 third that he was hitting 3-wood into. So it is long, Kit, and the weather's certainly not helping. People, Justin Thomas complaining about how absolutely freezing it is. So again, the balls won't be travelling as far. So who for you, anyone that came to mind, springs to mind, who maybe do very well the highest scoring tournaments? Because a couple of people have said they think 4 or 5 under might get the job done at this USPGA. Do you think that could be the case?
Yeah, I can see that. The heart bleeds for the tour pros when it gets a bit chilly, doesn't it? But you know, it's the northeast of the states, Rochester, New York, sort of upstate New Yorky. And yeah, that is going to be a factor because the ball's not going to travel quite as far. We've already referenced how long the course is. To my mind, it's kind of a USPGA dressed up in US Open clothing, if you know what I mean. That test is looking similar. I would kind of echo with a lot of what the guys have said. The 2013, not much of a read from that. But I do think you can have short players that do well here. And the fact of the matter is, even the best players in the world are going to miss more fairways and greens on this course than they do week in, week out. So therefore, the pressure falls upon the short game and the putting. And it's the guys that are a bit shorter generally and have to think their way around the golf course that lean on that and use that as a crutch more weeks than not anyway. So I think, like Tom said, they litter the top 20 often and the top 10 at these courses that you think it's just a bomber's paradise. And no doubt, I think you will need to hit the ball a decent distance through the air because you're not going to get a lot of run as well here. But the targets are tiny, not just the fairways. The greens are really small as well, especially for a course of nearly 7,400 yards. So I think if I was looking for value, I'd be looking at the Webb Simpson type character, not necessarily the Webb Simpson now, but the Webb Simpson of 5, 6, 7 years ago, who always seemed to turn up in a tough test. You know, someone like Justin Rose, I know we're going to talk about the English players in the field in a little bit, but someone that relishes a real difficult grind out there and that can just get it done when par is a good score. I think that style of player, just to expand it from, yeah, you know, we've got Jason Day hits it high and has just come off of a win. The top three in the market, obviously the best three players in the world right now. I would go beyond that and look at maybe if you're looking for odds, because the bookies are going to look at it in the same way we are and give deference to the big hitters, go for someone with a really, really tidy short game and not super short, but can get it up and down, basically.
Yeah, okay, well, great insight into the course there from you. Well, thank you very much. And I think it's time now to get into the field and have a look at who the guys are tipping for success this week. Yep, it is jam-packed at the top of the market. We do have the world number one, John Rahm, and number two, Scottie Scheffler, leading the way at 8-1, with Rory McIlroy just behind them at 12-1. But there's some interesting other storylines going on. Obviously, Scheffler's been in fine form, fifth last week. John Rahm looking for his second major of the year. Rory McIlroy started the season well, but slightly fallen off of that miscut at Augusta, really standing out. We've got Jordan Spieth at 50-1, looking to complete his career Grand Slam, and Justin Thomas, who loves this tournament. Both his major wins coming at the PGA Championship. So he could be someone to keep an eye on. Kit, just looking at the top of that, there is a bit of a gap overall, I think it's fair to say, with Rahm and Scheffler to the rest, essentially. What is it about them, particularly in their games, that have set them apart from, say, Rory and others so far this season?
General brilliance and consistency, I think, would probably be the two things. You know, Scheffler's been the most consistent player this year. Couple of wins, no worse than tied 12th in his 10 starts this year. Always seems to be in and amongst it. The one thing that you would say may have cooled off in recent months and certainly held him back at the Masters, I remember, is the putter. It's just, it's not terrible, but it's cooled off. And when you look at John Rahm, there aren't really any weaknesses statistically. He hits it a long way. He's off the back of that Masters win. Scottie Scheffler did miss the cut at the PGA last year off the back of winning the Masters. But, you know, that felt like a bigger thing for Scottie Scheffler, first major. He had that incredibly hot start to the year. For Rahm, he's more used to contending in majors over a more prolonged period. There just doesn't seem to be a weakness with John Rahm at the moment. And I think another important element of that is that over the last 2 years, you can include mentally as well. He's really grown and matured as a golfer mentally to go with just the incredible skill set that he has physically and technically. And, you know, when you look at everything, it is hard to look beyond those two. They are well worthy of being the top two players in the world and the top two in the market. Rory McIlroy was amongst them. At the start of the year, we were talking about the big three. The putter's just ice cold, and he hasn't turned up in the big moments, the big one being the Masters this year. And that's the question mark. Two question marks over him at the moment are major form and big moments. He's not won a major since the 2014 PGA Championship. And that putter. And I don't know that we've seen enough since the Masters with his one start and a not particularly good finish at a course that he absolutely loves in Quail Hollow to convince me that he probably... Do you know what? I think he's closer to Scheffler and Rahm in this market right now than he should be. You know, you look at Rahm and Scheffler and you just cannot argue with what they've done, not just this year, but over the last 18 months to 2 years. They are head and shoulders the best two players in the world. They've demonstrated it week in, week out in the biggest events. And when you look at the stats, and you need bombers, you need guys with their skill sets here. So, you know, they are the head of the market, quite rightly so.
Yeah, as you say, they're deservedly there. So, and we will find out now from the guys if they are going to take on Rory with any other picks. Sadly, they won't have general brilliance stats to look at on the PGA Tour website. It might be just below total driving, but let's get into it.
General brilliance is a combination of all of the other stats. And when you just see a lot of ones and twos and threes next to their stats, that's when it just becomes general brilliance for those two.
Okay, perfect. Good to know. We'll be adding that to the website as soon as we can. So let's get into them. Matt Cooper, let's start with you. Who is the headline pick this week for the first major on the tips?
Yeah, well, I was a little bit torn with this because I echo everything Kit said, and I think Tom would agree quite clearly John Rahm and Scottie Scheffler are the most likely winners of this tournament. The big thing when you're betting is the price correct? You will believe that somebody's most likely to win, but it's like if you roll a dice, if you're getting 3-1 for whichever number you pick, it's a mug's game. So I was very torn there, but Scheffler and Rahm are quite short, but in the end I have gone with Scottie Scheffler. I just think his consistency and the amount of time he contends in majors since he became a full-time member on the PGA Tour. He's got 7 top 10s in 11. His only dodgy effort was, as Kit has explained, after he'd won the Masters. This year in stroke play events, in 7 of the 9, he's been within 3 of the lead after 18 or 36 holes. So he's getting in there. He's getting into the meat of the golf tournament. And then he's hanging around. And also at the Masters, he finished tied 10th, which is a heck of an effort for a defending champion at the Masters. He was pretty disappointed with it, but he actually also said, I did a lot of weird stuff and I was still in with a chance of contending for the tournament. So he knows that he's got the game. And I just like the way that he acts. I think I've got this slight feeling that the difficulty of this course could just rile John Rahm. John Rahm is, as Kit said, the difference between the two at the top of the order in the way that they go about the game. John Rahm fights and takes on the course. At his best, he's like a bull on the rampage, but at his worst, he's like a bear with a sore head. And there's a possibility he could be that, I think. Scottie Scheffler has this thing where he's separated golf performance from who he is as a human being. And I think he's got the temperament for what could be a very, very difficult course. And the final little clincher was he's from New Jersey originally. That's where he was born. He'd been brought up and lives in Texas. But coming back, I think the crowds are going to like him. And the raucous New Jersey, New York galleries can really cheer him to victory, I think.
Yeah, well said. I mean, I saw your tip and I went into the stats. Normally I try to find a gem of someone who ranks highly in something. He's just won in everything. Strokes gained tee to green, strokes gained off the tee, total driving. And the one that did stand out slightly further down was bogey avoidance, which given this, you know, there's going to be plenty of them, could be very important to sort of get that winning score. And another thing him and John Rahm have in common, they both four-putted at the Masters. So good to see they are actually human after all. So that's 8-1. And it was a 3-point win only there from you, Matt, on Scottie Scheffler. Tom, big moment. The first tip on the tips from you overall. And it's a major. Who have we got headlining?
Yeah, I mean, the nerves are already settling in. But just before I dive into that, like I completely echo what Matt said. Like I think it was kind of like, to me, it was, I've never had a clearer picture than John Rahm winning at Augusta. Like, it felt really comfortable. Scottie Scheffler was in great form, obviously, when he won at Augusta last year. And it wasn't an absolute surprise that he missed the cut at Southern Hills, considering he actually heaped so much pressure on himself and saying it was like the best course, you know, his favourite course, whatever. It just felt too much. And this time around, he hasn't got that. And I think that, like you say, the relaxed nature of the course and the setup will help him. So I really like that. But for me, first tip, Patrick Cantlay, which is a real surprise for me, actually. I tossed and turned with this one. I looked at Justin Thomas based on his PGA Championship record. And then I just realised that actually he's not playing quite as well as I want him to. And when you're looking at 18 and 20 to 1, you kind of want everything going the way you want. So Patrick Cantlay is basically, if Scottie Scheffler and John Rahm are the best two players in the world, which they are, Cantlay may well be the best driver and the disruptor of those two as well. So the fact that he's kind of got a bit of added distance compared to maybe what we consider is great. He's not ranked outside the top 12 in strokes gained off the tee in his past six starts, and four of those he's been inside the top three. The knock on him will be that he's not really contended for a major championship. But I think that's, you know, when you think about Tiger Woods' win at Augusta, it gets lost in the commotion that Patrick Cantlay really had a chance to win that golf tournament. He was 12 under and in the lead after the 15th hole. So I think that's got to be bearing in mind. His best finish is third in the PGA Championship in Bethpage, albeit a distant one as well. You look at two of his wins at the BMW Championship, they were in the northeastern region, which I love as well. So everything kind of points to me that Patrick Cantlay, I think we can now say, is potentially the best player about a major. I know that gets thrown about between four or five different players, but I think he is the one. And he's the one this season that I don't think has been rewarded for his great play. And what better way to do it than to win your first major championship? So a little bit anecdotal with Patrick Cantlay, but also plenty of stats to back it up in terms of tee to green off the tee. And I just think he's been a little bit overlooked based on the fact that he hasn't quite got that real... Like, I don't think anyone's got the image of him trying to win on a Sunday at a major championship just yet.
Joe LaCava on the bag right as well now. Could the experience of Joe LaCava, having done a lot in the game, especially alongside Tiger Woods, is that the missing piece for Patrick Cantlay?
Yeah, so the only reason I didn't necessarily include that was with Scottie Scheffler, it was like very much Ted Scott's coming from winning two Masters and then brought that to him. And Joe LaCava, obviously, wealth of experience, brilliant caddy. I don't know necessarily there's much improvement that needs to be made in Cantlay. His short game could be a little bit tidier at times and he misses some opportunities. But maybe it's just going to be, like you say, with LaCava, it's going to be that experience. It's going to be just the settling him down in the moments if he does get into that unfamiliar territory.
I think it's the between the ears, the mentality stuff, yeah.
Maybe just keeping him on track. Like, sometimes I think he gets in his own head, talks himself out of things as well. So I think we've only seen one tournament with them together, and I don't think it was a fair representation of what Cantlay could do either. I don't think he massively loved Quail Hollow, despite the fact he played really well off the tee there again. So to me, it's a really interesting thing to see. And, you know, Kit, if that does happen, it will be a case of, you know, we'll come to Sunday and it'll be, oh, Joe LaCava's on the bag and that's why he's done it. And it makes sense. Like, it could well be. We saw it with, you know, Adam Scott, the Masters, and things with Stevie Williams. So it definitely does happen.
Yeah, he's a great experience. And he's actually coming off caddying for Nelly Korda, I saw on the LPGA last week as well. So he's got some form behind him, does Joe. So 18-1 for Patrick and 2 points each way for Tom's opening pick. Over to you again, Matt. Slightly bigger odds for tip number two, I believe.
Yes. Tip number two, I'm going with Shane Lowry. And I was quite interested and quite pleased, actually. In our first show, Ben Coley put up Adrian Maronk, who I was also on that week. So I doubled up on him. And me and Ben have, I think the only other podcast I've ever been on with Ben was back at the Open in 2019. And we were both very keen on Shane Lowry. So if me and Ben are coalescing in our thoughts, I'm very happy. And I've seen that Ben has also put Shane Lowry up this week. I mean, my first thought was, I saw his price. He was originally three figures. I think he's now 80 to one generally, partly as a consequence of the fact that Ben's backed him. I just think that's a potty price. I mean, Shane has been shorter than that for a lot in recent times. I think there are problems and reasons why he's been put that price. His form's not that great. But even so, his tee to green game was absolutely fantastic in the first two rounds at Augusta, and the problem was he just couldn't hole a putt, and finally it kind of wore him down. But he still finished tied 16th. And if you look back the last 2 years, he's finished top 25 three times in the majors. You know, he finished eighth in this tournament in 2019, and also that helped him win the Open a couple of months later. He contended in the PGA in 2018, second in the US Open in 2016. We mentioned Firestone earlier. He won that in 2016. The reason why we were mentioning that is it's a par 70 like this week. It's got quite a lot of straight holes, and also the yardage is eerily similar to this week. So that could be. Also, that was a course that everybody always said good drivers of the ball, and it's long. Kind of like the identikit profile for the winner is very similar to this week. But I mean, ultimately, I just think Shane Lowry loves majors. Major after major, he says, I like peaking for these weeks. He's not quite peaked like he did in 2019, but he's done very well quite recently. And I just think when I saw that price, it confirmed everything for me. It's almost like the flip of what I was saying earlier with the dice. I feel this time I'm getting a roll of the dice and someone's paying me potentially 10 to 1 if I get the number.
Yeah, and his total driving, as you say, seventh there. And I think the putting at Augusta was an anomaly. He ranks number one on the tour for approach putt performance, spotted there. So I think it was just basically nothing was going in, but he was sort of scaring the hole throughout. So yeah, he's around the 70 to 80 mark, depending on bookies. And that was half a point each way from Matt, allocated there for the Irishman looking for his second major. Number two from you, please, Thomas.
Yeah, so Victor Hovland. Just to me, if there's a player that's telegraphing a major win, it is Victor Hovland. He was in the final group for St Andrews. He was in the penultimate group at Augusta. And to be honest, I was really, really surprised at Augusta to see him race out into that kind of first round lead. And it really just stuck in my memory, is this going to be him now for the foreseeable? And of course, it's hard to keep up that kind of consistency, and that will be the knock on him, especially the one overriding thing that everyone's going to say is he's not going to be great around the greens or, you know, in the 30, 40 yard approach shots. And I do understand that. My idea is that he doesn't miss too many, is the hope. You know, his ball striking is absolutely superb. He does everything that I want. And I just think he's actually been slightly underrated in terms of his major performances. Like already in his career, four starts in the Masters, he's made all four cuts. He's had two starts in the Open Championship. He finished fourth and 12th. He's made all of the cuts in this tournament, albeit not really made too much inroads in it yet. And the two times he's missed the cut or missed the weekend of the US Open, once he withdrew as well, he actually finished 12th and 13th the other two times, one of those being at Pebble Beach, which had smaller greens as well. So when you think about Victor Hovland, the knock is that he doesn't win in mainland America. That's always the thing that happens. And we kind of get these things stuck on golfers, and it sometimes just affects them. It doesn't affect them, but it affects your mindset on them. And that's what I think's happened with Victor Hovland. I think he's an absolutely superb golfer, has all the tools barring the around the green. But interestingly, didn't lose, you know, massively at Augusta or in the last couple of tournaments that have been the majors in terms of around the green. So I think he can pick it up. And to me, just the way he's hitting the ball, like if Patrick Cantlay is the best driver of the golf ball, Victor Hovland's not far behind at the moment. So just the way he's been playing consistently, irons, driver, those two major lead-ins with St Andrews and Augusta, absolutely fine to give Victor Hovland another chance in the PGA Championship.
Yeah, if he does find the green, he ranks first in putts per round. I don't know if you guys have deliberately done it. We've now had first, second, seventh in total driving, and Hovland's fourth in total driving. So there's definitely a trend there. And the one that caught my eye, because of all the rough chat going on and is tighter. He is first from approaches inside 100 yards from the rough, which could be a fair few of those this week, and second in total from rough proximity to the green and pins. So he definitely is something worth looking at if they keep it up. So he is 28-1, and that's 1.5 points each way allocated from Tom there. Number three of four from you, please, Matt.
Yeah, I should probably explain also, I have got, if this was countdown, I have gone one low number and three very big numbers, please, Rachel. And so the second one is Russell Henley. And I just like the fact that he was fourth at the Masters, and also just the attitude that he got when he was talking afterwards. He said, I knew I'd got the chance of getting my best major performance, and I really went out and got it. And he clinched that fourth. I mean, it's about time he did it, because he's played over 30 majors and he's never made a top 10. So I'm kind of on the knife edge here. But it's also a brutal fact that 22 of the last 24 major winners contended in one of the three majors before they got their success. And by that, I mean either they finished top eight or they're in the top four heading into the final round. And I think that sort of thing matters. Tom's alluded to that twice with his picks so far, that these guys have got experience in the heat of the kitchen. And I think that really, really matters. A key example was Danny Willett at the Masters. He impressed everybody with the way that when he got the chance, he grasped it. And you might not think, well, why did he do that when he had no experience? A lot of people forget that he was actually sixth at the Open a few months beforehand, and he played with Zach Johnson. And he actually said after that round, I've watched Zach Johnson potentially just win the Open. He didn't know that he was going to win a playoff at that point. If he goes and wins it, I've seen what someone does to win. And I think that sort of thing really, really counts. Now, Russell Henley is not in quite such a glorious position. He just finished fourth at the Masters. But it's also a case, people like Corey Connors in recent times, Mackenzie Hughes, they've done very well in one major, and they've done very well quite quickly soon afterwards. Henley, I think, could be the man, because he's done pretty well so far this season. He's a winner in Mexico. He had a top 20 at Sawgrass before the Masters, a top 20 at Harbortown since. I also just like that he's quite good on Donald Ross courses, third and 12th at Eastlake, and his last four starts at Sedgefield and Detroit, they're all top 10s. Now, I'm not getting really, really excited about Russell Henley. I just think he can contend this week, and I will be quite happy if he makes the top eight, which is the widest kind of sphere you can get if you're getting about 100 to 1. So, yeah, I think he can get involved. If he pulls it out the bag and becomes a sort of Jason Duffner, Sean McKeel, fantastic. But just get in contention, please, Russell.
There you go. Yeah, Russell Henley, as I say, three figures still available there for him. And that was 0.5 points each way. Okay, Tom, time for your third one. I think we are getting to the Rachel Riley approach of higher numbers from you now as well for number three.
Yeah, so basically my final pick will be the one that I convinced myself was going to win on Sunday night. And by Monday morning, it was this guy that I thought was going to take over. So it's going to be Gary Woodland for me. And we talk about one thing being missing from your game, and I've said it with Victor Hovland, Matt's kind of said it with Shane Lowry in terms of the putting at the moment. Gary Woodland needs to find a putting stroke. It's very simple. Like there is no two ways about it. But when you look at about the fact that he's only had three top 15 finishes in 2023 so far, I don't think that really paints the whole picture. So he actually had his best ever finish at Augusta, where he was 14th. He was 9th at Riviera, and then 14th just last time out at Quail Hollow. But his tee to green game has been ridiculous in recent weeks. He was third and first his last two starts in tee to green. And then when you look at the overriding numbers, 10th in approach, 10th in strokes going off the tee, 22nd in tee to green, which is only lit down by his around the green numbers, 8th in driving distance and 12th in total driving. Then you look at his kind of proximity set to his irons. He's third in approaches over 200 yards, 5th in 200 to 225. And 7th in 250, 275. It seems to be that the further away he gets from the hole, the better he is, which is a great thing for something of a major course like this. And he also, if he does get himself in the nice mid-iron range or short iron range for him, he's 11th in 150 to 175. So to me, Gary Woodland, the way he's striking the ball is absolutely exceptional. And what I like about Woodland is that we've seen that at his best, he can do it. He's a US Open winner. He's won at Pebble Beach on small greens. He's got back-to-back top eight finishes in this event in 2018, 2019. Crucially, I think, at Bethpage Black in 2019, when he shot the round of the day on Sunday to climb inside in eighth place. So to me, everything that Woodland's done, he's also got top 10 in the US Open as well, in addition to that win. To me, it's just exceptional. Like, I actually don't I convinced myself he's going to win, which is great for an 80-1 shout. What does Gary Woodland? It's always been the same thing, right? Like, there was always a knock on him that he couldn't win because he didn't make the crucial putts. Then he started making the crucial putts and winning, and then he's gone back again, and that's what's letting him down. Everyone has to have a weakness, unless you're Scottie Scheffler or Jon Rahm at the moment, and that is Gary Woodland's. I'm not going to hide away from it, but just the record he's got in these similar events and the fact that he's hitting the ball so well, I think it's his time to surprise again.
And it's his birthday on Sunday. If you Brilliant. Attach any significance to anything like that, it could be a birthday victory. A nice little.
I didn't need any more convincing, but now you're telling me it's a birthday.
I'm all in.
It's great. I just think he's excellent. I think he's a really good player. He's been a top talent for a really long time, and he's actually eerily similar to the person I'm going to put up last in terms of like how I view him as a player. And yeah, I think that the crucial US Open win is kind of what drove me when you look back in recent success.
Yeah, having a win at a major is obviously massive, and there will be a lot of long approaches. So those numbers from 200 yards and in, the staggering that he's top 10 in basically all of them. And I remember him just using that driving iron to perfection, which we'll probably see a fair bit again. If the putter's hot, he'll do well. He ranks first for scrambling around the fringe, which is crazy. So as soon as the flat stick, he just panics, essentially. And he's a very lowly, though, 12th in total driving. So he's really letting himself down there compared to the rest of the pick, clearly. A final, not to put you off, of course. Final one from you, Matt. Who have we got?
I'm going to go with Chris Kirk, who I just think is an enormous prize for somebody who's actually won this year. We were talking earlier about little winks that major winners give us, and we kind of ignore them. A really obvious one is just winning that year. Wai Yang did it, Darren Clark did it, and we still, they haven't got a hope. This guy won at the Honda Classic on a course that has hosted the PGA Championship, and he actually has said this year that as he gets older, he's become a very good, tough golf course player. And actual fact, he was fifth in this tournament last year, so a little bit outside my three major running thing, but that kind of works for me. I also quite like the fact that he actually said last year when he played Southern Hills, again, I was playing a Colonial Legacy link at Southern Hills at that occasion, because Perry Maxwell designed both Southern Hills and Colonial, but Kirk actually said, I really love playing here because it's a big boys version of Colonial. Now, if this week is also a big boys version of Colonial, I'm brilliant, because Chris Kirk loves that golf course and he's a winner there. But he's also got he's only played East Lake once, Donald Ross, and finished fourth. And then I was on him at the Masters as well, and he was 23rd there, and I think he played better than that. He got off to a very poor start on Thursday and kind of climbed back into it. But he was almost kind of fighting it thereafter. I probably can't give that as an excuse given what Jon Rahm did at Augusta, but he didn't fight back quite as well as Jon Rahm. Initially he was much bigger than 200-1. I think 200-1 is now the general number, but I think that's a very big prize for somebody who's won and done it on tough golf courses.
Yeah, he is. He's actually 225-1, you could still get there. So that was for 0.5 points each way, which was the same as Gary Woodland for Tom Jacobs. And also, looking at some of the pictures, there seems like a fair bit of protection bunkering around the greens. And he's very good from the sand as well, ranks top five for that. And his putting's phenomenal. First in putting from inside 3 feet and third in three putt avoidance, which could be crucial. These greens looking slick on the stint meter, if we can go by the Insta videos. So there you go. That's the final roundup from Matt Cooper and final pick, which just leaves one more from Tom Jacobs.
Yeah, I don't know if Kit had a point there.
I was just going to say, so I think Chris Kirk would be a wonderful, wonderful story if he's in the hunt come Sunday with all he's been through. Yeah. I mean, if those that aren't familiar, he had to step away from the game, had some real alcohol issues. I think we often undervalue the stresses and the strains that professional golfers go through. You know, we all know how stressful it can be with a pencil and a card and your monthly medal at the weekend. These guys are doing it for a living. We often spend a lot of time focusing on the guys that are doing it well. And Chris Kirk, when his form went off, he unfortunately fell back towards alcohol, got into some bad habits. And I think it says a huge amount about him as a man, the fact that he's had to step away from the game a little bit, get his life back in order, if you will, and has come back really, really well. And I think a little bit of added perspective as well is always a nice thing to be added into the mix. And Kirk's certainly got that now.
Yeah, well said, Kit. Beautiful. Okay, last one from you, Tommy Jacobs. Who have we got?
Yeah, so just to really add into Chris Kirk, because apparently we're all going to back up Chris Kirk here, even though we're not picking him. I looked at his career way before, and when he came back to this kind of form, you know, middle of last year and this year, I always like to look at it, it's a bit the same with JJ Spawn. What did they do at the very start of their PGA Tour career, and how good were they? And the answer for Chris Kirk was very, very good. You know, he won twice in 2013, he won again in 2014. He had a couple of second place finishes in there as well that people probably quite easily forget. And when he wins in 2023 at the Honda Classic, it's like, you know, Chris Kirk's been a bit of a journeyman, but he really wasn't. He's just had kind of two parts of his career. And as Kit alluded to, is the backstory is there as to why. And when you see a player, I felt like this about Jimmy Walker in recent weeks, when you see a player lose their form for a reason outside of golf. So Jimmy Walker's was obviously the Lyme disease and struggling with that. Like I always wonder what they're going to do when they're back to playing their best and healthy. And he was fifth in this tournament last year, which is actually his best major finish, which is really important. So just adding some Chris Kirk things there. But my final pick and the person that I thought was going to win until it was Gary Woodland again was Justin Rose. And I was glad to hear Kit give him a nod at the start of the show about he could be the kind of tidy guy that can win this tournament. And I think that's really true. I mean, if we're making up stats for the PGA Tour, resilience would fit with Justin Rose as it would with Chris Kirk. I don't understand. Like, he was like probably, I think there was probably best price 90-1 about him at the Masters. He went down to 66-1, and that made perfect sense. He was in great form. He'd obviously just won at Pebble, and he's got a great track record at Augusta. But I think he's been pushed back out to 125-1 this week. And I don't really understand why. Like, what has Justin Rose done wrong in the weeks since winning at Pebble Beach and contending at the Masters for a good period of the week to suggest that he should go backwards? So when you look at it, he was ninth going into the final round at Augusta, finished 16th, which I think was tidy enough for a player that, you know, isn't the best player in the world like he was at times going into Augusta, or certainly in the top five. And he's got four top 10 finishes in this major championship. Two of them have come in the past 3 years. He's not finished worse than tied 29th in the PGA Championship over the last 4 years either as well. So he's just been absolutely phenomenal. I don't think he's quite going to be the Phil Mickelson of 2021 in the sense that, like, it would be a miraculous victory. But just the, you know, it does feel a little bit last chance saloon for him, but, you know, just over 40. He's got a little bit lease of life. And when you look, we talked about Donald Ross designs and form, and he's been a winner and a runner-up at a Runnymede Golf Club, which is a Donald Ross design in Pennsylvania, neighbouring sort of state here in the Northeast. His sole major win came at Merriam, which again was in Pennsylvania at the US Open. He's got 6th and 16th place finishes at Plainfield, which is a Donald Ross design in New Jersey. As Matt alluded to earlier, New Jersey could be a, you know, significant factor. And he's also got 2 runner-up finishes at Eastlake. So when we're talking about someone that's got that group of form, we're talking about he's got previous as being one of the best players in the world. What does Justin Rose have left to prove? The answer is nothing. You look at kind of Pinehurst, the 2014 US Open, he was 12th. Shinnecock in New York, he was great there as well. He finished inside the top 10. So to me, I think his form's being overlooked a little bit. Like, he was, as I said, going much better at Augusta than his final finish says. He was second going into the weekend at the RBC Heritage before falling away. Like, what does Rose need to add in his game to suggest that he can still win a major championship? The answer is nothing, which is why I'm going to bet him at 125-1 this week.
Great. He's, yeah, 0.5 points each way. Same as Chris Kirk. I mean, 8 amazing, which will come to you in a second, Kip, but 8 amazing. I mean, I'd be shocked if we'd have 8 of the top 10 now on the back of the ladder. Convincing. It's just staggering. Yes, Kit, anything on Justin?
Yeah, no, I spoke to Justin a few weeks ago. I had a really good chat with him, actually. And I think the one thing that would be missing in the modern age, you might argue, would be the power. Interestingly, yeah, he's swinging it as quickly, if not now quicker, than he ever has in his career. He is at this stage in his sort of mid to late 40s. He's adding speed, as so many of them are. So, you know, he's long enough. He's certainly long enough to compete. And as well, when we mention about these tracks with the long rough, the speed and the power isn't just about getting it out there off the tee. It's if you do find yourself in the rough, have you got the muscle power to get it moving forwards and to do it with a bit of control as well? And I would say Justin Rose, with the speed he's added in the last 6 to 12 months, has probably just about moved him into the sort of speeds where you are in that category, where I think he is just about quick and just about long enough to be a legitimate contender here, as well as all those other great points that Tom makes about his wonderful career.
And I think, sorry, just to add there, like I think that was a really important point because I did note it down here that like he's not one of the biggest hitters on tour. And I think why we've seen players like Justin Rose and Adam Scott, and maybe to a slightly different point, like Rory McIlroy, lose their certain edge is because their distance back in, you know, 2014, 2013 was really significant to their success. And all of a sudden everyone's kind of lifting their way. Justin Rose has been left behind in terms of distance. He hasn't, as Kit said, he hasn't got the most pop off the tee, but he has got that speed. And ultimately I think that he hits it far enough, like Matt will think with Russell Henley and Chris Kirk. And he's just got that excellent short game. He's got that mental aptitude that will lead him to success. He's great out of the bunkers this season. So to me, just that little knock that he doesn't gain strokes off the tee. So when you're looking for people with strokes going off the tee, it's not him at the moment. But I think he's the type of person that can overcome those sort of things as he has done throughout his career.
Great. Well, there's plenty of good names listed there, and we'll all be recapped at the end with the odds and points allocation as well. Before we move on to the specials market, we're trying a new game. It's called Name That Winner, gents. So what we're going to do here is, again, love a game. I'm going to give a little clue. We're going to get a hand up from you if you think you know who it is. So it is a previous PGA Championship winner from over the years. So the first one, for 5 points, I am looking for someone who is a qualified accountant. And if you don't know, I will move on. Good. I didn't want it to be too easy. I'm happy. Okay, we're on to 4 points now. Entering, they were all head shakes there. They have had laser eye surgery to improve their golf game. An accountant with incredible... Matt Cooper, hand up for 4 points.
I've got this totally wrong. I'm going to say Hale Irwin, but he wore glasses, so he hasn't had laser surgery. It's a nonsense answer.
There's a name in the back of my head, and it was from the accountancy thing. I don't know why this might be totally... Jimmy Walker?
Wrong again. Sorry. I really want a buzzer. We're going to bring that in as well. It's not either of those two. Just one glasses lover to another from Matt and no Jimmy Walker. So we're going for 3 points now. And this may give it away. This is a bit of a more known narrative, but you never know. My caddy married my wife's sister. Matt Cooper again.
Padraig Harrington.
The correct answer, the 2008 winner. Yes. There you go. It was actually at Oakland Hills Country Club. So very similar sounding course. But yes, well done. The debut win. We'll forget about Hale Irwin. We can edit that out. three points for Matt Cooper. Well done. So name that winner will come back every single major event we go to. Now it's time to have a look at the specials markets. Big win there for Matt Cooper. Hopefully we found the old winner in 2008. Hopefully we've found the winner in 2023 as well with the outrights. But let's have a look at the special markets. There are plenty of exciting markets to pick between. But first one, we're going a top 20 bet here. It's been 2 points you've been able to allocate here. So let's open up with you, Matt. Who have you gone for?
Yeah, I'm going to keep it quite simple. I'm a bit of a renaissance man this year, Ricky Fowler. The three seasons before this season, he got 4 top tens in those 3 seasons. He's doubled that tally this season alone. But yeah, I'm going top 20. He's got 10 in his 14 starts this season, 18 in 46 majors, 5 in 13 PGA championships. You can get 11-4 about Ricky getting another top 20. So I think there's a bit of value there. And I have a soft spot for Ricky Fowler. I was rather bizarrely once stuck in a lift, very briefly, with Ricky Fowler, his wife, and Bernard Langer. And I was the spare part. And I just sat there listening. I stood there, rather, listening to all of them being very polite to each other. And then afterwards, even more bizarrely, Ricky Fowler's wife asked me for a wine recommendation at the bar. I gave her one and she came back later and said, thank you, that was a lovely glass of wine. The Fowlers are lovely and I hope they get another top 20 this week.
Brilliant. I mean, tenuous stories at all times are fantastic. When you said Renaissance, I was thinking Scottish Open. I did a 14 club challenge with him there. He won the Scottish Open at Gullum. There's all sorts going on, Ricky. So I love that. So that's 2 points at 11-4 for Ricky Fowler, who will celebrate probably with the same bottle of red you recommended if he gets the job done. Tom Jacobs, who's your top 20?
Yeah, I remind me to never tell a story on the podcast because Matt always has some and I don't want to follow that up. To add to Ricky Fowler, like I think I've grouped him together in kind of Justin Rose, Jason Day, in that bracket, and two of them have already won, so why not Ricky Fowler at least contending in the major this time around? But for me, it was Max Homa to finish inside the top 20, and I wrestled with this one because the idea probably being that if Max Homa gets himself into contention, maybe you should just back him to win. But I think he's had such a hard time in majors actually getting himself into the first page of the leaderboard that we've seen with these other golfers like Patrick Cantlay, like Victor Hovland, that sometimes you serve your kind of apprenticeship finishing 14th, 15th, 20th, whatever. And I think that's what Max Homa can do. So he's got the one top 15 in the major championship and it came in this one 12 months ago at Southern Hills. He was actually going into the final round in 10th place and slipped down to 13th. Since then, 47th at the US Open and 43rd at the Masters. But final round 78 at Augusta really robbed him a chance of climbing into that top 25 again. So for me, for a player that's, you know, effectively the sixth best player in the world without those major performances, ninth in strokes gained approach, 13th tee to green, 10th in putting, 26th around the green, adding the fact that he's 22nd in total driving and third in approaches from 200 to 225, I don't see why Max Homa wouldn't make a good fit. I know there's a lot of interest in him for the US Open being in California, but I think he can do it slightly earlier this time.
Yeah, and he's, yeah, say 2-1, 2 points. And they're both be incredibly popular social media winners, Fowler and Max Homa. So hopefully they can get the job done. And let's look onto the Englishman, top Englishman market. And Kit, before we hear from the guides, have there been any standout English players for you so far this season? We've obviously had Justin Rose win, Matt Fitzpatrick, who I also, interestingly read, he's trying to do what Curtis Strange did. Won the US Open at Brookline in 1988, and then in 1989 he won the US Open, it was, but again on this course, which is very niche, but they both got good wins under their belts. Is there anyone, any name that's really standing out for you before we hear from the guys' picks?
I mean, the standout is the guy who leads the English market, and that's the guy you've just said, Matt Fitzpatrick. You know, I've already mentioned my appeal for Justin Rose if we're looking at this, and obviously Tom's on board with Rosie as well. But Matt Fitzpatrick, I think what he's been able to do, we've known about him on our side of the pond for a very, very long time, and I think it's taken the rest of the world, if you like, a little bit longer to wake up to him, and he's needed some bigger performances in the bigger events on the PGA Tour, and my word is he delivered that over the last couple of years. He has stepped into the very top echelons of the game, of course, now a US Open champion. His record in his last five majors, tied 14th, tied 5th, win, tied 21st, and then the tied 10th at the Masters this year. That's going back to the start of last year. He's a major performer right now. A big part of that is the length that he's added. But importantly, he's done that without losing out on any of the other elements of his game that we know are so strong. He's a very good iron player. The short game with that cack-handed chipping, you know, it works. He gets the job done, and he likes to hole a big putt when it matters. I love his grit and determination. He's a predator. He's a killer. When he gets in contention, we've seen it in Europe since he turned pro. When he gets in contention, when he gets a sniff, he finds another gear. And that's what separates the greats from the goods, if you like. And, you know, I think Fitzy has a chance to go on and put himself in that category of the greats with the rest of his career. He's on track for that right now. So I think he's rightly the top Englishman. And again, I just like his chances generally. Justin Rose, I think, and just to chuck in a third name there of the Englishman, Matt Wallace has kind of quietly been putting together a nice win, a winner on the PGA Tour in one of those opposite field events earlier in the year. So that doesn't quite get the fanfare that winning a regular, in inverted commas, PGA Tour might get you. But he's a winner this year on the PGA Tour. And he's a decent driver of the golf ball as well. You know, he shifts it enough. So if you're looking for a little bit more value, Matt Wallace would potentially be the name that sneakily is ticking a few boxes amongst the Englishmen.
There we go. So yeah, we've got Matt Fitzpatrick at 5-2, top Englishman, but the other Matt, 28-1, still available there, sort of three places each way you can get on those guys. Matt, which Englishman have you shared wine tips in the lift with? Who's leading your 1 point each way allocation here?
Nothing so brilliant in this one. I tell you, Matt Fitzpatrick, the fact that he got involved in this in the PGA Championship 12 months ago was so vital towards him getting the US Open, because he had a bizarrely poor major championship record before then. He couldn't get himself involved, and the experience of doing it. We were talking about how important that was before. And I think it's also quite an interesting thing. Tom's already talked about Max Omer. When you're a high quality player, eventually it's almost like you can't fail to compete at the top level. That there comes a point where you have to decide, is a pattern there for genuine reasons, or is it just a little bit of weird, odd dispersion? And I eventually Fitzpatrick worked out how to contend, and it helped him win. But the guy I'm going with is Tommy Fleetwood. I think he's in really good form. He was third at Innisbrook, fifth at Quail Hollow. He was in contention at Harbour Town. He was fifth here last year, fourth in the Open. So he's in good nick. I think Tyrrell Hatton maybe he's never quite done what I call this and the US Open the traveling majors in America. And Hatton's really struggled to get involved at the weekend. He's never been within six shots of the lead at the weekend. I think there's a possibility that eventually that will change, but at the moment it's not happened. So I think I think Tommy's a little bit nearer the top of this market than he is. I have to say, I think Tom is probably going to make a very good argument for his man in this thing. But in opposing him, yes, I will do so with Tommy Fleetwood.
Tommy, for top Englishman, you got 17-4 for 1 point each way. And just to round off the whole very comprehensive podcast so far on the second major of the year, Tom, who have we got for the top Englishman?
Yeah, so, as I said, I woke up on Sunday morning or Sunday night. Well, I didn't wake up on Sunday night, but I went to bed on Sunday night thinking that Justin Rose was going to win the PGA Championship. So why can he not win this top English heat? Now, he's 8-1 in this market. He was 10-1 at one point before, we came on air. But I think for me, we've already mentioned Fitzpatrick, Hatton and Fleetwood. Rose is, the outsider of that group. And he could actually lose his market by finishing eighth, because I think that Tyrrell Hatton and Fitzpatrick and Fleetwood could all factor in. I actually think this is probably the best chance English players have had to win a major in America for a long time. I think it's a really good venue for them. They're all in good form. I think they have benefited from the designated events and having to play more in America. I think that's worked out for them really well. But I have to stick with Justin Rose for all the reasons I listed in the outright market. He loves these tournaments. I love the form that he's in. He played very, very well at Augusta once again. Just got pipped there for top English by Matt Fitzpatrick. But I think he's going to get some revenge here and finish in the top English this time around.
Well, there you have it. What a detailed preview into the second major of the year and the first one on the tips. Time to say a massive thank you to our guests for their phenomenal insights. If you want to get in touch with any of them to ask them any questions or thank them for finding you a winner, then they're all on Twitter. Kit can be found with his handle of @KitOnTheCourse. Matt is @MattCooperGolf. And finally, debutant Tom Jacobs is @TomJacobs93. That's all from us. So now here's time for a recap of all the outright tips and special bets. Starting with Matt Cooper's outright picks for the US PGA Championship, we have Scottie Scheffler 8-1. He was 3 points win only from Matt. Shane Lowry next at 80-1, half a point each way. Russell Henley, 125-1, also half a point each way for Matt. And finally, Chris Kirk, 200-1, again, half a point each way. And looking at Tom Jacobs' outright picks, Patrick Cantlay opened up for him, 18-1, and that's 2 points each way. Victor Hovland at 28-1 was 1.5 points each way allocated from Tom. Gary Woodland, three figures, 100-1, half a point each way. And finally for Tom, the Englishman Justin Rose, 125-1, half a point each way for him. Moving on to the specials, we look at Matt Cooper's picks. For top 20, he had Ricky Fowler at 11-4, and that was 2 point bet. And then top Englishman was Tommy Fleetwood at 17-4, 1 point each way. And that's three places you can get there for Tommy. And then Tom Jacobs, his top 20 bet was Max Homer at 2-1 for 2 points. And to finish off was once again Justin Rose. This time the top Englishman's the market, and he is 8-1 again, three places for that. Good luck this week with all of your bets. Please remember to always gamble responsibly, and when the fun stops, stop. But do enjoy the US PGA Championship from Oak Hill Country Club, and we will see you next time to look back on that and preview the KLM Open and Charles Schwab Challenge. See you then on The Tips.